Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're honored to be joined by Indy Srinath. Indy is a forager, educator, gardener, mushroom cultivator, and steward of both her environment and her community. In her early adult life, Indy became convinced that conventional education and claustrophobic small-town living was not for her. She followed a calling to spend more time in the outdoors and accumulated extensive experience in organic farming and permaculture. Over the course of her back-to-the-land journey, which notably includes co-managing a 7-acre farm in North Carolina, Indy developed an intimate relationship with wild foods and foraging. Now, what makes her story so unique is that her work has brought many of the principles we discuss on Mushroom Hour, wild food, mycology, permaculture, environmentalism, into urban settings and into a relational context with BIPOC communities. Hers is a message rooted in what I would call radical self-acceptance and the potentiality of paradigm-shifting change that's possible with the widespread adoption of back-to-the-land practices, so long as we pursue these practices with the acknowledgement of the massive contributions of BIPOC and non-European peoples. Indy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yay, thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, I'm really excited because I followed you on Instagram for a long time, tons of wild food knowledge, tons of amazing style. My partner and I are always like, oh my God, look at her style. Look at the look she's serving us right now. So it's really fun to get to talk to you in person. And we're going to dive into some topics that, I mean, are of monumental importance when it comes to changing our direction to be more in homeostasis with the planet. But like I said, also in that context with the moment we're having right now where we're not able to ignore anymore this relationship the BIPOC community has with everything, including wild food mycology, areas where we don't necessarily think of that right away. But before we take this deep dive, I'm really curious. I'm sure everyone listening who follows you is really curious about a little of your life story and the journey that you took to develop your relationship with the natural world, your relationship with wild food, farming. And obviously, it's your life story, so that could be many podcasts, but I guess the version of just the synchronicities and the important points that got you where you are today.
Yeah. So I think I got into agriculture in general just by happenstance, because I grew up in a really small town on the East Coast in North Carolina that was very agricultural based. So I saw a lot of farms growing up. That was the landscape that I was surrounded by. And I was always interested in farming. I've always loved animals and loved plants from a young age. And then when I was in high school, kind of as a joke, I just joined the Future Farmers of America Club. And I was like, oh, this is kind of funny. Like, yeah, future farmers. I don't know. It kind of had a comical aspect to it. And right. Then as I started paying more and more attention during meetings, I was like, hey, actually, this is something I can kind of get behind. I really do enjoy growing food and seeing things start from seed and flourish into something different. And then from there, I started woofing. So using the online platform of Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, which for folks who aren't familiar with it, it's just pretty much couch surfing or Airbnb, but for farms. So you work trade in exchange for room and board and access to farming practices. So I did that in my younger adult life from 19 to 21. I just woofed on different farms up the coast of California in what I kind of call a quarter life crisis of like, I'm tired of traditional education and I want to do something different and I want to grow food and make friends and make money and explore a different lifestyle than the one that had kind of been fed to me.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's kind of how I got started, first as a joke and then as a deeper exploration.
Part of us as humans is programmed to want that relationship with the land and to grow things and to be out in nature like that. So I think that's totally natural. And I think a lot of us are having that quarter life, maybe it's midlife, wherever you're at, everyone's kind of having this desire to be more integrated with natural systems. And I hear so many people having these pulls to do this. And thank you for explaining what woofing is, because I've heard it a couple times and always played along like I knew what that was and kind of got the idea. But I didn't realize it's a whole structure where people can actually integrate to get farming experience, because I think it's something we'll talk about a lot, because access to land and space where you can actually start putting some of these principles like permaculture and farming and organic farming into practice is what's really at the premium. So that's great to know that people interested in this have a platform where they can really get involved.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's an excellent resource. And now in the age of technology, the WWF website feels a little rudimentary and outdated, but I still encourage folks to explore that website, and it's available worldwide. So if you're interested in farming and want to apply for a visa and go to Greece and learn how to grow olives, you totally can in exchange for room and board. So it's pretty lovely.
Yes, please. Greece to grow olives. I'm there. Now, when did a relationship with foraging enter the fold? And specifically, when did you fall in love with kingdom or queendom fungi?
After I finished a year of traditional university, four-year university, I was kind of disheartened with, number one, the cost, and number two, the classism that I see running rampant through four-year educational institutions. So at the time, I very much could not afford to go to college, but I felt as though having an education put you a bit ahead in life. So I sought out herbalism school because it was a school that I could afford and work full-time during the day. And so when I entered herbalism school, one of the major key components of the curriculum was plant identification. So we spent a lot of time doing field work with Newcomb's field guide and just hanging out with plants and learning them by their Latin names. And I just became enamored with learning the names of all of the trees and plants around me. I very much felt like I knew the names of major brands of food and snacks and sodas and fast food and all of that. And right. How is it that I've been walking past a huge maple tree my entire life, but am not able to identify it? So in that way, it feels kind of rude and dismissive of the actual plants that are making it possible for us to exist. So in that pursuit, I started noticing more mushrooms inevitably, because I was living in Asheville, North Carolina, which is very biodiverse and a temperate rainforest. And so I was, you know, kind of bypassing fungi on my little plant walks, looking for golden seal and ginseng and all this. And I was like, oh, what are these mushrooms that are just growing out of the ground? So I started trying to learn their names as well, even though that wasn't a part of our necessary education structure in herbalism school. I just really noticed their ephemeral nature. So with plants, you know, you can go back day after day and find the same plants in the same area, but mushrooms are a lot more enigmatic, and you'll see one day and you go back to find it the next day and it doesn't exist anymore. And that's the beautiful short life cycle of the fruiting body of fungi. So I guess I was just excited in that way. It kind of felt like a shooting star versus a solitary planet.
There is something amazing about the coalescing of circumstances that are required to find a mushroom that makes it all the more special when you finally do, especially if you actually find what you were looking for. Like, oh my gosh, the stars aligned. Now there in Asheville, was that also where you ended up being a steward there on that farming space? I believe it was a 7-acre farm there in Asheville.
Yeah. So right on the outskirts of Asheville, I worked on a 7-acre forest farm for a number of years where we cultivated shiitake mushrooms outdoors, also cultivated herbs and cut flowers.
Yeah.
So that was a really lovely experience. Yeah.
So you're able to put a lot of these skills you've been developing into practice.
Yeah, right into my home base. It was really practical and efficient and fun, of course.
What I've noticed that's really interesting is now you're not in North Carolina any longer. I believe you're in LA. Is that right?
I am in LA, yeah,
Okay.
concrete jungle.
Yeah. Well, and I know that you've then kind of turned this knowledge you have of the plant world and of the mushroom world and brought that into the urban environment. And I just think that's really interesting because it's a potential that we don't always tap into, but I think it's really important to kind of ameliorate the urban claustrophobia, if you will, with like some natural space and some relationship with more than human organisms. Was that your experience in both herbalism and then in managing that farm in North Carolina, your woofing experience? Did you find a way to integrate that to the urban environment? Was it even difficult? Or maybe just talk about that transition to applying some of these practices, I guess starting with farming when you got into an urban space.
I felt like the transition from a very forest, like you have to drive down a gravel road to get to my house, experience that transition from there to an urban environment really freaked a lot of people out because they didn't see it as a part of my life goal. Whereas I felt like in diving into agriculture and growing food and foraging for food, this was always a part of my plan. I never wanted to just scream into the echo chamber and say, "Hey, we should all hang out outside around folks who are already hanging out outside." So bringing it into this urban environment in LA has been really dreamy and has kind of been a beautiful end cap of my education. So a lot of the permaculture practices that I developed in North Carolina have been able to practically apply in an urban environment. Right now, I'm managing a lot less area. I'm on a rooftop garden, which is rather small, but amazing and gets full sun all of the time.
Yeah.
And it's just an amazing way to employ all of these skills of stacking functions and water conservation and growing food in a small contained area for a large number of people who really need it and aren't able to grow food on their own. So I've felt like it's been the perfect path for me, and all of my education thus far has kind of led up to this goal.
I find that more and more as I go down various rabbit holes of information that I'm interested in, is there comes a point where you then have to bring that information to people that don't know it yet that can use it. Like you're saying, you can't just be around like the intentional community that thinks exactly like you do because then you're not really helping anyone. So it's really inspiring to hear you take that information and then bring it into the urban environment. And you know, there's a lot that goes into these concepts, whether it be, you know, so many different names, biodynamic farming, permaculture farming. There's a lot of names around this. It seems to me like the biggest core elements are around, you know, promoting soil health, capturing nutrients in as closed a cycle or as closed a loop as you can. But what are some of the basics from the permaculture skill set that you're applying? I mean, you just said water conservation and function stacking. Are there a couple others that are like basics of permaculture that maybe people listening who live in an urban environment could apply to their patch or their own rooftop garden?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important permaculture skills or tenets for me is diversifying your skill set. So, or just diversifying your property in general. So for me, that includes drawing in folks who have different levels and backgrounds of experience. So I have no interest in just recruiting folks in the garden who are avid gardeners. My favorite people to work with are carpenters and people who've never planted a seed in their life but are just simply passionate about it, or even to the converse, people who don't even like vegetables but just enjoy seeing flowers growing in an open space. So I really like to diversify not only the plants that I'm growing in the garden in order to create richer relationships, but also the folks that I bring into the garden. So I feel like that's been one of the most important tenets for me. And diversity not only of skill set, but of course also of ethnic and any sort of identifier background. So folks who are on a broader gender spectrum, I always want to create a welcoming open space for those individuals to come into the garden and learn from someone who's who wants to also learn from them. So I want it to be a really symbiotic relationship where as much as they take away from their experience with me in the garden, I'm also able to learn from them if they're open to that.
More perspectives is always better. And I love that idea that one of the simplest permaculture principles we can take away is diversify everything. Mm-hmm. Because that leads to kind of the greatest strength. And in watching a couple of the videos you've had, videos and books that showcase your work, I noticed that you were for a time a steward also of a community garden space. Do you see a developing role for the community garden in urban areas? And how difficult is it to get that kind of space up and running? Because I see that as such a big part of a solution when you talk about people needing more exposure to natural environments, needing that connection with hands in the soil. I mean, you even talk about augmenting your diets, you're enhancing food security and kind of combating food deserts. But how difficult is it to get those spaces started? And then do you have any advice for people who might want to start a community garden?
Yeah, so I have been really privileged in my access to these spaces. So the community garden that I managed when I was in North Carolina just kind of happened upon me, and an individual reached out and said, hey, we have this about acre of land in a low income, predominantly Black housing area in the middle of the city. Would you like to manage it? And that's like a dream come true for me. So I kind of stumbled upon that. And then in LA, I also manage an urban garden that serves the houseless population. And I kind of stumbled upon that as well. So I feel as though if folks do want to get more access and find these community gardens, they're out there, but they are kind of under-marketed because a lot of the gardening work is just hard work in the soil. And at the end of the day, I mean, I can attest to it. You're pretty exhausted. And the last thing you want to do is coordinate volunteers. And as much as I enjoy outreach and bringing folks in, it's just difficult for one person to do. So I think it's a bit of a conundrum because there's that feeling of you're someone who's stewarding the land and you aren't in the Western traditional ownership of that land. So finding and having access to these areas and pouring your heart and soul and resources into them can feel a little daunting. So I encourage folks to just reach out to any community gardens that are led by folks who they have trust in, whether that's a spiritual or a religious community or a neighborhood community. Usually those community gardens are kind of easy to find on social media platforms.
Yeah. And maybe it just, when you brought up that idea of land ownership and kind of Western Eurocentric way that we look at land and property, it always, to me, becomes the crux of any creation of new systems or new ways of living, new ways of being that all of us are yearning so much for. You know, the hyper-industrialized, hyper-capitalistic system we live in, everyone has this gnawing feeling, unless you're like at the top of the pyramid, you have this gnawing feeling that this isn't the way we should be doing things. But to really like try and build something else, which at the heart of that is food and growing things and kind of life. But to get the space to do that and explore these ideas, you always need space and you need property. So I just wondered, you know, how you navigated that. And it sounds like kind of reaching out to people who might have that potential and not being afraid to reach out to the gardens that already exist, because they probably want you. They just haven't had the time to post on Instagram about it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think this is something that, full disclosure, I'm still learning, because when I kind of look over the life that I've led in this field of permaculture, I have stewarded and practiced regenerative agriculture on so many different pieces of land, yet I have no stake in them, no permanent stake in them other than an emotional attachment. While that kind of floated me through my early adulthood, and that's kind of an idealistic view of things, I feel as though now I'm more in a space where I want to include more people of color in the work that I do and expand my capacity to educate other folks. So owning land seems more necessary now than ever, even though I don't subscribe to the idea that anyone can truly own land. I'm kind of having to play into this capitalist framework that I'm already inevitably a part of.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the paradox. When the dominant paradigm is structured this way, inevitably you're going to have to play along just enough to get something where you can build the alternative. And, you know, that's something just that stood out to me as we go through this cultural consciousness and evolution of realizing how BIPOC peoples have been neglected, how their contributions have been neglected, and everyone's becoming hyper aware of it. The key next step for me, and part of this is because I have a background in finance and accounting, part of the next step for me has been looking at, well, people need access to credit, people need access to land. Basically, they've been disadvantaged in a capitalist system that has largely preyed upon them. Not to go too far down that rabbit hole, but I've been in the finance and lending industry, and I know it happens. I know people are targeted, and it, you know, affects their future ability to gain credit and have access to things like land. So I think it would be great to see a big movement where people are empowered with easier access, especially people like yourself who have the drive and really the knowledge to be productive and make great use of a piece of land. We need to think of some kind of social structure that enables that. That's my little soapbox. I don't know what it looks like, but like I see Wells Fargo and I see banks posting, you know, kind of performative things like BLM. And I'm like, well, are you guys going to make it easier for people to get access for a loan on land, maybe even without a house? So that's a big thing banks won't do. They won't lend unless you have a house on the property. So it's just one of those paradoxes I think everyone's navigating. And I hope one of the big outgrowths of this current movement is the realization that that is a core component to moving forward, is giving people access to land and space to feel empowered and have more of a say than politically and all those other things. That's kind of my little train of thought on farming and space. But then, and we'll get into more of those topics. Obviously, I kind of jumped the gun a little bit because I also want to hear about how you've been able to explore wild food and make use of sustainable wild food sources, even in an urban environment. And I think the one that stands out for me is your video of finding a morel in LA in the middle of some wood chips. We're like, what? So what are some ways people can still forage, even if they're in a more metro area?
Yeah. And I definitely enjoyed your, I feel the exact same way about, you know, we should really put more of an emphasis on what larger corporations and what banks can do versus putting all of that guilt and shame and burden and responsibility on the individual. So yeah, I feel like it wasn't just a for nothing soapbox rant. I really agree with that. But yes, foraging in urban environments, I feel like foraging has become so ingrained in, for me, it's kind of a meditative, the closest thing I personally come to in terms of spirituality practice, and also a major food source. Because on the East Coast, I was getting so much of my protein and just like staple foods from the forest. So it was kind of a no-brainer when I moved to the West Coast in an urban environment. I was like, there's no way I'm going to just stop foraging. I'm always just looking around. I mean, I think it's really frustrating for folks who are the passenger in my car because I kind of slow down and I'm always staring out of the window and like asking the passenger, like, do you think, was that an oak tree? Is that, you know?
We'll just turn around for a minute.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Just pull off on the highway. I think it's just a matter of always look, like always keep your eyes open and, you know, really read your environment. So with morel mushrooms, I already knew about landscape morels and that they tend to grow prolifically in wood chips, and the wood chips should be about like a year old. So I've always, even on the East Coast, checked around in wood chips, especially in the spring there, to see if there are any morel mushrooms popping out of them. And then in Los Angeles in particular, there's tons and tons of fruit trees and avocado trees and, you know, mainly citrus trees. So it kind of blows my mind when I see all of these like figs and oranges and things just falling to the ground and not being used. So it's pretty magical. It's like something that I would pay a lot of money for at Whole Foods if I saw it. And so Why not just grab it off of the tree when I am walking down the road doing something else?
I think California is unique in the abundance of fruit trees that are out there. Obviously, I'm in the Bay Area. It's a little bit different, but kind of the same. We have a lot of fruit trees growing and people just don't seem to pick them for whatever reason. I've heard the term gleaning. I think that's where you're taking fruit. Sounds a little bit like taking fruit that no one's using. I think that's a great resource. Now, in your own experience doing that, is it again something that you are able to like pretty significantly supplement your diet? Because that's mind-blowing to me if it is.
Yeah. So I feel like with mushrooms, I am able to supplement my diet. Like the morel mushroom patch that I found produces pretty consistently. And so I just keep drying them. And yesterday I made a mushroom gravy with them and put that on mashed potatoes and it was really tasty. And I still have a ton more. And with citrus, it's the same way. And I also have a really good friend who forages, her Instagram handle is Foraged Fruit, and she forages a ton of citrus for the sole purpose of giving it out to folks who need it. So I've been able to take fruit that I've foraged and also fruit that she's foraged and bring that to the houseless population that I work with. So that's been really incredible. I mean, I'm like up to my eyeballs in citrus, so I can't consume it all myself. So always my go-to is bring it to the folks over in LA on Skid Row.
That's incredible to think there's this untapped sustainable food source, you know, in kind of the last place that you'd expect it. And I guess, do you have any advice for people when you want to approach this idea of like, oh, I want to urban forage, take things off trees, look around for mushrooms, you know, maybe like how to do it without looking sketchy, if that's the right way to say it, you know, any advice for how to like practically go around town doing this? And maybe if there are certain hot spots, like certain shopping centers or office parks or anything that are good to start with, any advice like that?
I would always say, one is take into account who you are as a person. So for me as a person of color, I mean, I always kind of, and this is my coming from the Southeast feeling about myself, but very much growing up, I always felt as though I was treated differently because of my skin color and automatically seen as sketchy. For me, it's always like foraging in daylight and always bringing a buddy with you and always keeping your cell phone handy just in case the chance of any unsavory interactions happen, and making sure, like, doing that homework and making sure that you're not on any private property and nobody would have a reason to legitimately say that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. So always looking in public areas and especially looking for fruit trees that or forage goods such as mushrooms that are going to otherwise go to waste. And there's a really lovely app called Fallen Fruit, or maybe it's not an app, it's a website. Maybe there is an app as well. It's called Fallen Fruit, and folks upload geolocations of different fruit trees or mushroom spots or whatever that you can forage from. So I've used that a little bit. It's compatible with Google Maps. So that's really convenient. And I always encourage people to just walk around their neighborhood and become familiar with what could be growing. So if you know that you're in an area where, you know, we're in a temperate region and oyster mushrooms might grow, wandering around and looking for oak trees that the power company might have cut the tops off of, and seeing if any wild oyster mushrooms have taken over, that I've had great success with that. Also just being aware of what grows in your region. That's always important. So you know what you're looking for.
I think those are some great pieces of advice. I'm now going to be looking, whenever I'm in San Francisco or anything, going to be looking around at for those fruit trees, be looking for, oh, that could be a landscape morel spot. I was really inspired by you kind of showcasing that. And I love the idea of Fallen Fruit as an app where you can kind of share those wild food resources. Do you think that bringing an appreciation of wild food and understanding wild food and bringing, you know, some of these regenerative land practices that can be implemented even in urban areas, do you think those principles really do offer maybe some answers to the the big food desert question and for making more resilient communities and for really empowering what they call underserved or underrepresented, especially BIPOC communities. Do you think these two things we've been talking about are really key pieces to the puzzle and kind of more than just like a hobby or something certain people are into, but really like core parts of changing the situations in these areas and really addressing some of these problems?
One of the major movements that I love right now is folks are starting to change the language around food deserts to food apartheid, because that has more of a feeling of a victimless situation. So, and I think it's a little bit of being picky with semantics, but I think it is important to note that folks who live in food deserts, it's not like, you know, they just moved to Joshua Tree and they're chilling in the desert, but this is an actual apartheid and something that is being done to them purposefully by larger corporations. Right. So I think that foraging, yes, can help solve that and can bring in fresher food to these communities. But it's also important to realize that folks who live in food deserts tend to barely be able to survive with the wages that they earn from whatever job that they have. So to ask them to spend their free time tromping around like me in the streets looking for mushrooms is a little bit idealistic.
Right.
And I did do some outreach recently and just kind of gauged interest where I work in Skid Row, which is a largely houseless population, and asked the folks in that community where they get fresh fruit and if they like fresh fruit. And they did say that, yes, like we used to be able to pick from this one orange tree a couple of blocks away. And there was also an avocado tree on this corner. So I do think that folks in those situations enjoy supplementing or are capable of supplementing their current diet with wild foraged foods.
Right.
And so I think that that's where we can kind of bridge the gap, is like I do have a lot of class privilege and am able to spend more time foraging and in the outdoors looking for wild food. So the fact that I can bring those foods that I forage to those communities is really helpful. And if there are a few folks who are interested in doing that, then empowering them with the tools that they need to find that food on their own is something that I've been very interested in as well.
Yeah, that's really a good way to put it, is bridging the gap. Because obviously, in just asking the question, it's clear that I want these things to be able to solve some of these problems in urban areas. But really, it's not necessarily attainable for everyone. There need to be people who are helping bring this knowledge and maybe even bringing the food like you are to people who need it. And then ultimately, to address those kind of food apartheid, this is even maybe a Band-Aid there. And really, what we need to see is kind of structural change and investment into communities and building food infrastructure. So this alone isn't the answer. And I was thought that, but I was holding out for the idealistic future you were going to paint, to say, yes, everyone could just forage for food in urban environments. It'll fix everything. But I had a feeling there's a little more subtlety there. Well, this kind of brings us perfectly into the huge topic of intersectional environmentalism. Before I do my musings, what is intersectional environmentalism?
Yeah, so I feel like intersectional environmentalism was mostly coined and popularized by a really cool chick named Leah on Instagram. She is Brown Girl Leah, I think, or maybe Green Girl. But she's really incredible and inspiring. And so it kind of brings this principle of, I think a lot of folks are familiar with intersectional feminism,
right,
which is just a term that says, hey, we're not just adhering to the binary. We're not just saying like, oh yeah, men and women get along, or just, yeah, like Black people and white people get along and hang out outdoors. It's bringing in folks from all different identities and ethnicities and backgrounds, and saying that, again, linking back to permaculture principles, that it's important to diversify and make a more vigorous and vibrant wealth of knowledge. So I think that that's kind of what I think of as intersectional environmentalism, is just drawing in and pulling from a lot of different folks' experiences.
Yeah, and I like the way you said that because it really is bringing in other dimensions than kind of the two-sided spectrum we so often, you know, polarity. We so often run to polarity one side or the other. And really, there's like all these other layers and dimensions to a lot of these discussions. Another topic that I saw brought up, a lot of people are aware of, but we don't think in kind of a bigger context, I would say, is the idea of ethnobotany and ethnomycology. And I think a lot of us have this image of ancient peoples and how they developed with fungi or different plants. But there's kind of a more modern context, and there's this issue of how do we acknowledge the communities that really derived a lot of this information originally? What is the significance of ethnobotany and ethnomycology?
Yeah, so I think that for me, this is one of the most key topics to the work that I do, because it's just the anthropological approach to agriculture. So it's really person-first farming and highlighting the importance of the people who have tended and worked the land that we currently benefit from. So that spans from migrant workers who come from Mexico and grow and pick and harvest the majority of the foods that an average person eats that are found in the supermarket, as well as Black and brown folks who were brought from different countries in Africa and enslaved and forced to work the land that so many of us in the US and other westernized countries have benefited from. So I think that ethnobotany is just an overall appreciation of the ways in which individuals and human life has co-evolved with plant life. And I think that there's a lot of beautiful accounts of these ways that humans have, especially people from West Africa, have brought seeds to the America and are responsible for growing a lot of the crops that we see and benefit from today.
Yeah, so not only were they actually doing the labor that worked the land into the kind of the life-giving asset that it is, but they actually also brought the plants. And when you talk about migrant workers and you talk about obviously slaves at the founding of this country, you know, they weren't just working the land, right? They were actually implementing principles that they then taught to Europeans.
Exactly. And I think that that's where I kind of stray from the idea of permaculture in some ways, even though the, you know, father of permaculture, Bill Mollison, he's from South Africa. But I feel, which obviously has a very sordid history with race relation, but I feel like the majority of permaculture practices and principles are not just borrowed, but stolen and reappropriated by Western folks. So I think it's really important to just place an emphasis on how much we or Westernized countries have benefited from folks who didn't have a say whether or not they wanted to provide that sort of education or have their practices used for purposes that have effectively kind of ruined a lot of parts of our planet.
This concept that comes along with this is that idea of intellectual property. I mean, there are peoples who brought unique growing practices. And when you talk about permaculture, there are even examples of First Nation peoples bringing very specific plant groupings to bear that made use of natural systems, kind of made that permanent agriculture accessible so far back before Europeans adopted it. So how does intellectual property come into play here? Is there any way to redress this? I know that's a huge question, but is there any way to redress this and like somehow get these communities more involved, or what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's really been approaching it when I'm working with individuals, especially Black folks, coming from a lens of not shaming people if they don't know about a traditional or a modernized farming practice. So I think that that happened to me a lot when I first got into agriculture, is I felt a lot of overwhelm, and a lot of white folks that I worked with had access to education that made them able to out-talk me when it came to agricultural practices, even though I was practicing and employing a lot of the same skills that they were, because they had the freedom of taking a permaculture design course or had the freedom of going to a four-year institution that taught them how to grow in a certain manner. So I think meeting people where they are and creating a dialogue and conversation around what folks do know when they are in the garden. So saying like, hey, do you like eating green beans? And if they're like, yeah, then to me, that's important. And that means that they already have a relationship with this plant and they're already consuming it. And therefore, they respect and have reverence for crops, and just empowering people and uplifting people and not making them feel any sense of shame around what they do or don't know when it comes to gardening.
Especially when so many of the practices, and we're using this giant umbrella term permaculture, especially when so many of permaculture practices intuitively resonate with people. Like when you explain it, people are like, oh yeah, I see why that would work. Mm-hmm. So to kind of put it behind this barrier of exclusivity feels really wrong. And I am struck by how much, you know, we're in Northern California and there's a lot of hotbeds of different permaculture design and permaculture communities. And it does seem to be a mostly cloister of folks with European descent, which is always mm-hmm. kind of strange to me, is like getting back to the land. Well, this isn't really European land. So how are we reconciling that? You know, that's a whole other issue, is like, what is it like to develop a relationship, be of the land when this isn't your land? But yeah, I guess maybe folks aren't consciously being exclusionary, but do you think there are some ways that people can be more inclusive, like you're saying, by maybe meeting people where they're at, other ways to kind of bring people into the fold?
Yeah, definitely. I think offering access and being willing to share and demonetize education. So for me, if I can make my education free or share knowledge freely through platforms such as Instagram or social media, then I always try to do that. And I think that folks who do identify as white and are white, one thing that would be really helpful is marketing and media. I mean, I can't even count the number of flyers for primitive skills gatherings that I've seen that are just like a bunch of white people in buckskin dresses with knives. Like, that, there's nothing more intimidating than seeing that kind of marketing and advertising. And I understand if those pictures are just representative of the actual individuals who attend those gatherings. Right. And as a person who has consistently gone to primitive skills gatherings, I can attest that, yeah, it is predominantly white. But just because a gathering is predominantly white in populace doesn't mean that those are the only people who are practicing. So really taking that extra step and that extra effort to seek out and find and do that homework to find folks who are people of color, who are indigenous peoples, and bringing them in a role that is empowering to them as an educator or as a teacher or a speaker, instead of just saying like, hey, we're offering scholarships to Black folks to attend this festival, which I've seen a lot. And that's helpful, but it's not empowering, and it doesn't feel great to feel like, you know, the affirmative action person at the festival.
And that's what I was going to ask, is how folks, because that's a line that I feel like, especially people of European descent, people identify as white, you're trying to balance right now, is to not kind of take on that white savior role of, let me now go to every BIPOC community or person I can and tell them to come to my class and it's free. I'm going to show you everything I know. I mean, is that okay? Or where is that balance? And I mean, maybe you answered it by saying it's giving people roles that are empowering and making people feel included, more than like, hey, let me save you. It's more like, hey, help me set this up and teach other people. I mean, what is that? Is there a wrong way to do it, I guess? Is that even wrong to go out and say, hey, I've got all these skills. I'm a white guy who got into permaculture. I now specifically want to give this information back to BIPOC people who probably originated this ancient information. Like, is that even wrong to do? Should people be worried about that being too performative or anything?
Yeah, I think that's such a interesting, is the eternal question, because is there a right or wrong way to go about trying to make the world a little bit better.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are things that can be directly insulting, and I have felt in the past when people have offered me scholarships to attend events on the basis, not of my skill set, but on the basis of because I'm a Black person, and maybe they wanted to kind of diversify their gathering a little bit.
Mm.
That can feel a little wrong to me personally, just because I'm like, I said I was Black. I never said I was poor. Like, I can afford to come to this festival.
Right.
So I think moving away from that paradigm where Blackness equates to poverty is really important. Mm. And for all of us to examine the ways in which we think that those two identities are integrally entwined is important. I think that as long as individuals are making an effort and are actively accepting feedback and changing based on that feedback, then there's not necessarily a wrong way to approach it.
Well, and I guess to fail in the attempt to purposely redress past imbalances, to fail in that is kind of like a good type of failure. And that's something I've been talking with people about, you know, in this moment, again, where we're all hyper-conscious of these issues, is for folks who identify as white not to let the fear of failure stopping them from making that step. And like, yeah, you might fail and you might not get the reaction you expected. You know, someone might say, hey, are you targeting me just because I'm Black or just because I'm a First Nation person? And even if the answer is yes, like maybe that's okay to fail that way just to like try to move in the right direction.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree with that.
And you may not know this, but are there any specific farming practices or practices when it comes to knowledge of wild foods or maybe even wild mushrooms that come from a source that is not European, you know, come from a source of either indigenous peoples or peoples brought over from Africa? Are there any specific examples?
I mean, I think you touched on it earlier when you brought up the Three Sisters garden of the, what is it, corn, beans, and
squash, I think.
Squash,
yeah.
So I'm not super familiar with indigenous people's farming practices, but going back to what we were speaking of earlier with ethnobotany, I do make a purpose of in the garden that I currently manage to grow vegetables that are endemic to West Africa and in turn are ethnically relevant to the folks that I serve, because I think it is important to honor people's heritage, especially if you expect them to have any stake or desire to work in your garden. I work a lot with growing lemongrass and aloe vera and okra. Yeah, crops that were grown in West Africa and that people of color tend to enjoy gardening and have a lot of rich history and stories around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking for specific examples. That's probably the biggest one, like, yeah, all the plants that are staples of American life were brought here by other people. Do you think there's any barriers to BIPOC peoples getting involved in mycology groups or homesteading groups? I mean, is there something culturally where it just hasn't been marketed as cool? Are there ways for people that host events like that to be more inclusive and try to get people excited about it, maybe if they haven't been exposed to it in an urban environment, or if it hasn't been something that's been made a part of their like prepackaged culture, as we think of it as urban culture, if it's not been part of that yet, is there a way for event designers and people who are into this kind of information to make things more inclusive?
I think one of the largest barriers is access and representation. For me and for other people of color that I've interacted with, it's really great, like we mentioned earlier, to see someone who is representative of the ethnicity that you identify with in a role of leadership in those agricultural environments. So when I'm looking to go to different agricultural conferences and to learn for, you know, what might be 4 days of just hands-on learning, I really love when I see folks on the roster who are Black people and are non-Western people. I think that that's really important. I also think that making gardening and farming not such a daunting and arduous looking task, because there's a lot of, especially for Black folks, a lot of trauma around that. So I know that, like, with my family, when we look at just like that traditional row style of in the sun agriculture, it doesn't have a great feeling. And it's the way that any traumatized ethnic group would view something that is kind of a symbol of their strife and their lack of liberation. I guess I won't draw any parallels, but you could imagine what seeing a big plantation style farm.
We all get vivid images right away. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Would look like for a Black individual. So that was one of the main things that I did at one of the last gardens that I managed, was turn everything into raised beds in different geometric shapes. So that it wasn't just like this back-breaking labor over rows in the hot sun, and putting up shade structures as well. Just being cognizant of that and what farms might represent for certain people. And I imagine that the same might be for Indigenous American folks.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are ways to design your offerings that really try to make it more inclusive, and then maybe focusing on outreach, maybe not saying, hey, do you want a free scholarship because we know you can't afford this event, but maybe ways of reaching out to peoples that could benefit from this knowledge that don't identify as white, purposely to bring them in. You know, these are all ways, but are there any other big barriers or issues? I mean, is this enough? Is like making it inclusive, is basically just, are we saved by seeing it and then being more inclusive? Is that enough to get us on the right direction? Is there something, that big word of reparations, there's something we need to do to kind of redress the imbalance? Like, hey, we all grow all these crops that folks brought from West Africa, and now we use these planting practices that we took and saw First Nation peoples using and are marketing and repackaging it. I mean, is there some redress that you think should happen there? And that's a pretty huge question that a lot of people have thought about. But what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's so difficult because I think for everyone trying to repair the relationship between people with European heritage and people of color, trying to repair that relationship looks different for everyone. For some, it's a monetary reparation, and for others, it's listening more. And for some, it's, learning and volunteering and amplifying voices of other folks. So I think there's no catch-all way of repairing that relationship.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, it kind of brings us to our earlier point of land sovereignty. And of course, reparations in that form seems almost obvious and necessary. But I don't know. I think it raises a lot of issues for a lot of folks. So if that doesn't feel comfortable for people, then I think that there's other ways for them to bridge that gap and come together in a different format.
Well, and the big thing you're saying there is, I'm using this acronym the whole time of BIPOC. It's not a monolith. Everyone's different. There's individuals and groups that feel differently about this should be redressed, and I'm looking at Indy like, please give us the answer. And the fact is, there's no definitive answer that can be given. But yeah, circling back to our earlier point, having access to land, having access to space, I just can't get away from how crucial of a solution that seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you talk about, this idea of land ownership, I think in America and in most European cultures, we've divorced that from toil. Like, I am actually okay with the idea of private ownership, quote unquote, if it's something where you blended your labor with the land, that kind of makes it yours. Like, if you planted your vegetable patch, that is your vegetable patch because you put the sweat in, you put your hands in the earth. And I think now we have this situation where there are people who own massive tracts of land, hundreds of miles of land, and they aren't doing anything with it. So, I always wonder if there's some strategy where we could give people access to these areas to really get into these skills. And, the agricultural landscape of America, it mostly seems like it's folks who identify as white that mm-hmm. are the primary owners and quote unquote farmers of the land. I guess you've had more experience in farming circles than me. Is that true? Are there not that many BIPOC farmers? And maybe what are some ways that we can, what are some strategies where we can change that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's true. And I mean, it's just generational at this point. I mean, when we look at, if we just were to look at like my family heritage versus, you know, my white counterpart, we would see that like while my family was attempting to purchase land in areas that were heavily redlined, like in Chicago, let's say, and they weren't allowed to purchase land or houses in a certain area while their white counterparts were, then that just sets up a precedent for generations and generations to be unable to get ahead in life. So I think that a lot of white folks that I have encountered feel like, hey, I put in a lot of work and I do a lot and I garden all day and I, you know, work my butt off, but then they're unable to look at how they have inherited wealth generationally off of the backs of my ancestors. So although I don't think that the average white person that I, you know, see at the Froyo shop is like trying to put me down, I do think that on a generational level, their family was given some opportunities that put them ahead at the expense of my family. So that's a little bit difficult to come to terms with. And so I don't think that interpersonal reparations is necessary. I think that we should shame and hold accountable larger companies who have monopolies over certain areas and have them, you know, redistribute that land back to the folks who really deserve it.
I mean, it seems like some big change like that is the only way you address cumulative generational effects like what we're talking about. And just for people listening, what is that practice of redlining?
So pretty much that is the idea of the sectioning off of certain areas and the creation of certain areas in the 60s, 50s, predominantly black and making those neighborhoods already impoverished. So devaluing certain areas and putting people of color and specifically black folks in restricting them to certain areas of a city in order to further establish barriers past segregation, past legalized segregation.
I mean, it's creating like a permanent economic barrier that's almost mm-hmm. harder to overcome than social barriers where you can convince people to change their mind. You can change policy more easily than you can change generational economic barriers. So I just wanted to highlight that because I see this debate going on right now and there's kind of one viewpoint on the spectrum, and I might be oversimplifying, that's more conservative that says, hey, we all have personal responsibility for where we're at. And there's mm-hmm. another part of the spectrum that says, well, history matters and generational cumulative. And I think those two conversations live together, but I think we need to understand there are huge policies or huge decisions made by private institutions like banks that were largely responsible for redlining that have this huge undeniable cumulative effect. I mean, property values, it's the biggest asset any person owns. So to have that be pegged lower than someone else just based on your race, like, yeah, that is specifically disadvantaging you. And I love your idea of like not making it as much about interpersonal. It seems like those are personal journeys more mm-hmm. than something we can readily fix. But I like your call out to like big institutions, especially banks, that like, hey, you've had these practices like redlining that have disadvantaged people. How can you fix this? You know, we should be looking toward these people to make the kind of big sweeping adjustment that might equalize things. Now, do you see that access to land and that access to people being able to grow their own food as being something that could help restore or empower BIPOC peoples and start to kind of heal and bring them to a place where, you know, they aren't disadvantaged? Is this one of the biggest things, is kind of land and having that relationship with food, I mean, food sovereignty?
I think it absolutely is, because being able to grow your own food and it being specifically yours, or up to you as to what you do with it and how you distribute it and to what communities you distribute it to, is of paramount importance, because a lot of the health disparities that we see in the Black and Brown community include type 2 diabetes, obesity, and then of course birth complications and low birth weight babies in the African American community because of ancestral trauma. So I think that giving Black folks access to land and saying, here, you can move outside of this food system as we know it, outside of the obesity glorifying got milk campaign, like, you know, high fructose corn syrup diet that I and tons of folks grew up on, is really incredibly important. And when I do talk to folks about like what foods they enjoy eating and what foods they grew up eating, a lot of folks love eating fresh vegetables and fruits, but they simply cannot afford them. Because when you go to a store and you see that a banana at your convenience store, which is right in the middle of an area that doesn't have any grocery stores around, and a banana is $1.29 and a bag of potato chips with a bunch of chemicals is 15 cents, or, you know, then there's a clear choice. Yeah. So I hate seeing people between a rock and a hard place where they have to choose whether they want to get enough calories or whether they want to nourish their body. So
absolutely. I think that's such a huge part of the solution, because a lot of those insidious economic incentives do force people to make that most basic decision of what to eat. Food is medicine. We all know that, but that makes basic decision of what to eat suddenly is skewed to where you're picking something unhealthy, and that just dominoes into every other aspect of life. So I really appreciate you elucidating that. And then, do you think if there are communities, you know, people that are able to get land, build community and build farms kind of outside of direct European control or influence, I guess what I mean is European descended control or influence, do you think that's a chance for us to develop new paradigms of being and kind of organizing peoples and new ways of doing community? I mean, is all that possible too?
Yeah, I don't think that that's just like a George Orwell utopian dream. I think that that's very much a possibility. And right now I see a lot of the redistribution of wealth happening on a interpersonal low level, you know, friends and family donating $5 or $10 to folks to start their own farm. But I think that we can really scale up from there and really get grants from some of these larger organizations that owe it to us, that have introduced a lot of these health disparities into our Black and Brown communities, like, you know, Big Tobacco and Monsanto. So yeah, I think that that's really possible, and I don't think that we're that far off from creating that kind of reality.
And I think it gets back to that concept of more diversity leads to a healthier system, which hopefully leads to something new and stronger than what came before. Because I think, you know, when you have a system dominated by the same types of people, you're not going to get some different outcome or some radical new system. And that's why I think this concept of giving people land ownership, people who aren't of European descent specifically, because they have a different viewpoint and a different outlook, and that's where you get something new is birthed out of that. I guess, is there anything we're leaving out in this conversation? I mean, you're the person that has more experience in kind of every arena of what we're talking about, whether it's farm or foraging or being from the BIPOC community, of course. Is there any other angle on this we're forgetting, anything that's worth bringing up here?
I think one thing that I kind of always forget is one of the main reasons why I started relying more on books and online resources in the realm of foraging was because of the lack of inclusivity in the languaging around certain plants. And I don't know, I've created a few resources that kind of highlight this and haven't distributed them as widely as I could. But one of the main things that I noticed in going to these primitive skills gatherings and taking foraging classes is just the way we describe plants that are not endemic to the Americas. So I remember feeling very uncomfortable when I heard people talking poorly about non-native species of plants, calling them invasives. And I think that the languaging around that has changed a lot with people who are a bit more woke or a bit more culturally aware. But I think that saying like something as simple as talking about Japanese knotweed and saying that it's invasive and aggressive and non-native, and anytime you see it, you should pull it out of the ground, that sends a message to people who are maybe of Japanese descent or of Asian descent, like I am, that you aren't welcome here, even though you might be very medicinal and very helpful, just as Japanese knotweed is. Right. So I think we need to really look at the way we educate folks about the plants that are around us, because, you know, we kind of think of English ivy as, even though it's super aggressive and really difficult to get rid of, but we think of it as this vining plant of wealth, and you see it like covering brick buildings in the nicest neighborhoods that you go to.
Right.
But then we look at something like kudzu and we're like, that's terrible, because why? It's the same vining ivy. And wow. I think kudzu has really beautiful flowers. I love kudzu and kudzu starch and kudzu medicine. I've gained a lot more uses out of kudzu, even for basketry, than I ever have of English ivy. I think it's just important to really pay attention to the populations that we're working with and how certain languaging around plants themselves can turn off people to our message.
And that's something that I had never thought of. And it's funny because that's something that's so, you know, that idea of quote unquote native is so relative to, you know, human populations. Like plants and mushrooms have been moving around this planet for millennia. And whether or not we consider it native because, you know, it's been there since we got there, and now something new's moved in, well, in 500 years, they might think of that Japanese knotweed as suddenly native because they don't remember a time when it wasn't there. Really interesting, though, to think about how that, just in the language and how we frame these things, cannot be inclusive. Thank you for breaking that down. That's the curse of becoming more conscious, is it's like a rigorous principle that always gets applied. And suddenly it's like, oh my gosh, now I got to be more conscious about everything. But that's the beauty of it. And that's like, there's always higher levels.
Totally. Yeah. I've very much felt that way about Home Depot recently. I'm like, oh man, I love going to Home Depot. I wish no one told me that they give tons of money to the Trump campaign and they're a terrible business to support. That's the price that we pay. It's like, oh man, we have to like break apart every fun place that we go.
We have to see it. We have to like put the glasses on and see what it really is.
Yeah.
That's part of the growth I think we're all going through. And that's where we like get to the other side of this thing, is by everyone on that personal level, having those levels of consciousness, making those right decisions, however arduous or inconvenient it is. Well, I guess I know this is a time of upheaval for everyone and no one knows what's next, but do you have any future plans, any things you're working on? And then maybe where can people find more about you and find any resources or any of your work?
Yeah, future plans. Oh my gosh, take a nap.
That's a good one.
Relax. No, but I have been trying to integrate more self-care into my daily routine and really advocate for myself as a person of color and not do more emotional labor, even in just daily conversations, than I should. But future plans, yes, definitely own land and grow food and feed people. That's the three things that I try to do every day. And I feel really good about it. As far as keeping up with me, Instagram is the best way to reach out and see what projects I'm up to. And in my bio, there's a link tree to my Patreon account. which is where I've been uploading media as time goes on. And then folks can always feel free to shoot me an email if they feel like there's any way of collaborating. And that's also in my Instagram bio. Everything's kind of centralized there right now.
That's awesome. And I do encourage people to add Indie to your Instagram feed because it's like a little healing. Every time a post goes by, there's like some great wisdom. There's always an awesome picture. Are you into photography? Do you do your own photography or do you have some like professional photographer that follows you around? Because your pictures are amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I do my own photography and wow. just spend, I mean, you should look at my camera roll. It's like 30 pictures of one cucumber. spend an inordinate amount of time taking photos of the same thing
to get that one amazing shot. Well, it definitely shows. This is a question I like to ask people that I kind of bypass, but are there any mentors or other people that folks should follow, you know, whether they're into this information specifically we've been talking about, or maybe just in general, mycology, permaculture, are there mentors or people of note you want to throw out there for people to also follow?
I couldn't remember her Instagram handle earlier, but Green Girl Leah. I really, really love the work that she's doing around intersectional environmentalism. And then Amber Tam as well. She's doing some great urban farming work in New York, in Brooklyn. Those are the two humans that come to mind.
Yeah, when she, I believe Amber Tam just had her big crowdfunding campaign to get land and get a farm.
Yeah, I am so happy. I am so proud of her. And I love everything that she's doing. And she's like super, super amazing. So yes, so inspiring. So inspiring.
For me, it kind of brought into my head, like, this is the answer. This is what we should be doing for people who feel like they're not getting the justice or acknowledgement. It's like, we need to empower people with land, because that's how Europeans that came to America were initially empowered. It was by getting land and taking ownership that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I usually have a couple of wrap-up questions I like to ask people. I think you've been really open and awesome, and I think people totally get your vibe, but I like to say it gives us a little more of a window into your spirit and teaches us maybe about a cool mushroom we hadn't heard of. But what is, because it's the Mushroom Hour, what is a mushroom that you love and why? And this could be just a mushroom of the moment, an all-time favorite, you know, whatever the case may be, but a mushroom you love and why.
Ooh, yeah, it is Mushroom Hour. Mushroom Hour. Okay, so I would say it's kind of a tie. I love warm tones. So I'd say one of my favorite mushrooms ever is Hypomyces lactiflorum, or lobster mushroom. So I guess a lot of folks might argue that that's not technically a mushroom in and of itself. It's in its botanical name, you can see Hypomyces. So it's a fungus that's taken over another mushroom. So it's a fungus that's colonized Russula mushrooms and rendered them more edible. And they're just these huge, funky, orange, warm-toned, really earthy-looking, thick mushrooms that grow. I've found them predominantly in pine forests. And they're super tasty. They taste like lobsters. And they're in the forest, and they're beautiful. And you can find them in abundance in the Pacific Northwest, as well as I've found them in the Southeast. And I think they're super tasty, and I have a bunch of them dried that I creepily carry around with me. And they're great for making mushroom lobster bisque and turning into gravies and just tricking your friends into thinking they're eating lobster chunks. And then that kind of ties with Cordyceps militaris, which is that same kind of vellum, grainy outer coating orange mushroom. And I just think they're really cool because they're entomopathogenic, so they take over insects and use them as a sustenance body. So I think they're really cool too. So I guess it's kind of a tie between cordyceps and lobster mushrooms.
A couple aliens that take over other things, but that look bright orange, yeah, with that beautiful texture. Those are two amazing ones, and I have yet to find a lobster mushroom in the wild, so you've given me visions of lobster mushroom dancing in my head.
Yes. Awesome.
Kind of a more general question, but what has a relationship with fungi given to you. That can be spiritually, emotionally, physically, whatever it is. What is the relationship with mushrooms and with fungi more generally given to you?
I feel like looking for mushrooms, I think I touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'm not like a spiritual or religious person. I'm very science minded and I like facts and figures and books and charts. But I do think there is something a bit meditative about looking for mushrooms, and it kind of is a synthesis of doing that research and figuring out which mushrooms grow where and why they grow where they grow, and then just chilling out and wandering through the forest and kind of learning to read the forest. So I think a lot of people feel like nature speaks to them, and I don't necessarily feel that way, or I don't feel like nature speaks to me in like any sort of English language, but I do feel like I can read it. So I can say like, oh, okay, like we're in a pine forest right now, and kind of judge what the fallen pine needles might do to the acidity of the soil, and then what mushrooms might grow based on that soil alkalinity or acidity. So if you learn a few things about the trees and the soil, then you kind of have a cool roadmap into what's going on the planet.
That idea of wanting to be present, to be mindful, like you're saying, foraging kind of forces you into that mindset. And I do like that idea of it gives you a better sense of the forest, where it might not even be like a purely intellectual thing. You can just start reading things and get an idea and read the situation. That's really interesting. And we've talked a lot about big general themes and big solutions about massive social generational issues. But what is the lasting impact you hope to make with your work as either a part of greater trends or just a legacy you hope to leave behind, or ways maybe you hope to inspire others? But what's the lasting impact you hope to make with your work?
Yeah, for people to feel empowered to just start growing something. Like it can be as simple as finding a seed in your cucumber that you're eating at dinner and putting it into some dirt that you dug up from a planter that you shouldn't have gotten it from, and putting it in a styrofoam cup and putting that in your windowsill. Like that to me is incredible work and is resilient agriculture. So I really just want everyone to feel empowered to grow in whatever capacity they can, and not feel like they can't grow food just because of where they live or who they are.
Yeah, and I love that about your whole message, this idea of empowerment and wanting to kind of move to the next level, but loving yourself the whole time, where you're not judging yourself. I get that so much from your work. Well, Indy, thank you so much for walking through some really big issues with us. I mean, sharing so much of your personal story, yourself, your insights. You've just been a pleasure to speak with. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun. I feel like it's just like having a fun talk with a friend.